Iowa is defined by fertile soil and gently rolling hills, and the forces that created our landscape during the Pleistocene epoch are still at work today in other parts of the world. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the power of glaciers. Iowa State University geologist Neil Iverson and a team of researchers will be spending part of their summer living and working near a glacier in Iceland. I'll talk with him about what we can learn about our past and our future from his research into how drumlins, elongated oval-shaped hills, are created by glaciers. We'll also look into our past with geologist Deborah Quaid. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the power of glaciers. Later in the hour, we'll explore how the Iowa landscape was formed by glaciers. But first, we're going to start with modern glaciers. My guest is Neil Iverson. He's professor and Smith Family Foundation Departmental Chair of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University. His research team has received a three-year, $400,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to study a particular landform called drumlins, and he'll once again be spending part of his summer camping near a glacier in Iceland. Hello, Neil.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, thank you for coming back to the show, and describe what drumlins are for us.
They are oval-shaped hills that develop not next to glaciers or on their surfaces, but underneath glaciers, and they're elongated in the direction that glaciers move. One of their curious properties is that they tend to occur in really big groups. And so if, for example, you drive from Madison to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you'll find yourself driving up and over these hills and looking out across this pretty flat landscape that has these very conspicuous elongated hills rising out of it.
All right. And so this is a landform that's not uncommon in the upper Midwest.
It's not uncommon at all. We don't have any in Iowa for reasons that are still quite mysterious, but there are outstanding drumlin fields in Wisconsin and Minnesota, upstate New York, lots of places. And in countries like Canada, which of course was completely covered by the last ice sheet, something like 70% of all the landscape developed in one way or another underneath the ice sheet.
So what are you hoping to find out about this landform?
Well, this is one of these really long-standing mysteries in geoscience. You know, they've been studied for over 150 years. There have been over 1,300 publications on drumlins, and yet we still don't really have a good idea of how they form. And that really reflects the fact that they form out of view, you know, usually beneath glaciers that are long gone, that have been gone for well over 10,000 years. And so we're hoping by being able to study drumlins in Iceland that have very recently been exposed, we're hoping to learn something more. And one of the ways we'll be able to do that is to make use of the fact that we have good information on this particular ice cap in Iceland when it was covering up and making the drumlins. Usually people studying drumlins don't have that extra bit of data.
Because the ice cap was there in a prehistoric time.
Right, exactly. And in this case, we think the drumlins formed over the last 100 years. And there's lots of good imagery of the ice cap at that time that allows us to make statements about how fast the ice was moving, about what the surface of the ice cap looked like. That's really important information to try to ultimately develop a quantitative model for how drumlins form.
With all of the information that you can gather from evidence like that, from pictures, what do you need to gather from the glacier itself?
Well, it's a little bit hard to make measurements on that glacier itself that are relevant to the formation of the drumlins. And the reason is that this particular glacier in Iceland is what we call a surge-type glacier. A surge-type glacier moves along normally for a period of several decades, and then, for reasons which we think we understand relatively well, speed up by a factor of 10 to 100 usually. And we think it's during that surge phase of this glacier that the drum ones were sculpted. And so basically the glacier right now is in a state that doesn't tell us that much about the state of the glacier when the drum ones actually formed. Fortunately, though, we do have imagery and some measurements and word-of-mouth stories about the ice cap when it was surging and forming the drum ones.
You have been to this particular spot before, right?
Yeah, we made a reconnaissance trip there last August to sort of check out the viability of a larger research effort.
All right. And what kind of team will you be returning with this time?
The team has gotten a little bigger than we expected at the front end. There are really about 13 researchers who are involved, and at any one time there'll be about 10 people working in the field. Four of these people are students. Two of them are graduate students from Iowa State who are just starting out this year. Two of them will be undergraduates from the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee. That's where my co-principal investigator teaches. Another is a postdoctoral researcher from Iowa State who will be in charge of the geophysics we'll be doing on the drum ones. And then in addition, there are a number of Scandinavian faculty members from various universities in Sweden and Norway and Iceland, and they are part of this as well. And they're part of this because they were the group that really discovered this drumland field as the glacier receded and exposed the hills.
How long will you be there this year?
This year, we'll be there in total for about 20 days. Not all of us will be there the whole time. I and some of the other senior researchers will be there the first two-thirds of the period. A helicopter will be coming about two-thirds of the way through to pick some of us up and drop some of us off. The students and another person I should mention that I neglected to mention before is a high school teacher who will be joining us from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. He is part of NSF's Polar Trek program. He will be in charge of streaming video and images of the research in real time back to his community in Idaho. He will be there the whole time, as well as the students.
Give me an idea of how remote this area is that where you'll be camping.
Iceland is not as remote a place as many places in Alaska, for example, or in the Canadian archipelago where there are lots of big glaciers. But it's effectively kind of remote in this case because there are big glacial rivers that are shed off the ice cap that are not bridged in any way, and you just can't get across these either with a vehicle or on foot. And so this means that we have to get to the forefield, the front of the glacier, by helicopter, which complicates the logistics somewhat.
And would complicate logistics of leaving if you needed to leave as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah. Fortunately, like a lot of Europe, their whole cell phone system is a lot better than ours in this country. And so we actually have reasonably good cell phone access from this place. And so if there is an emergency, if a big boulder falls on someone or something like that, we can get them out pretty quickly.
What will the weather be like in August next to a glacier in Iceland?
Glaciers, of course, exist in places where the weather is inherently bad, right? I mean, if the weather's nice, there won't be a glacier there. And so this is a place where it rains a lot, and that really reflects the fact that Iceland is sitting up there in that part of the North Atlantic. It's subject to a lot of low-pressure systems that move through. The glacier itself, though, tends to promote pretty high winds. Air over a glacier tends to be under a quite different pressure than air adjacent to a glacier, and this leads to big, steep pressure gradients in the atmosphere that create high winds. And so the winds are pretty strong. And so the sort of typical weather there is both windy and rainy. Temperature, however, isn't so bad. I mean, it'll at night it'll get down to near freezing in August, and in the day, if it's a nice day, it'll get up into the 50s.
All right. Of course, with winds, it might not feel quite that nice, and the rain.
Yeah. It's that can make it uncomfortable.
And this time of year that you've chosen to go there is a time of year known for better weather, right?
It is. If you look at the weather statistics for the Icelandic highlands, this is probably the best time to go. Or July. July is also a good time. The problem with July is that this is a natural area as defined by the appropriate federal agency in Iceland, whose name I don't recall right now. But in any case, it's a wetland with lots of nice bird life, and there are restrictions on helicopters flying around during July that we're also trying to avoid.
You're taking in a big team, and you'll have to go in by helicopter. Does that limit the amount of things you can take with you?
To some extent it does, but the plan is to drive two four-wheel drive vehicles with trailers to within about 20 miles of the glacier. And then the helicopter will fly from Reykjavik. It's about a 1.5-hour flight. The helicopter will come meet us at this staging area, and then our equipment will be flown over as hanging loads to the camp in front of the glacier. And so we can have multiple hanging loads brought over, and so that allows us to, you know, bring all the food and equipment that we need to be reasonably comfortable and to do our work.
We'll talk more about this. We have to take a break in just a minute or two, but... So this glacier, as you mentioned, is not surging at the moment.
Correct.
What can you actually study? What kinds of research will you be able to conduct by looking at this glacier and these land formations, although it's not necessarily in the act of creating them right now?
Right. We're going to be looking at, again, images from the ice cap when it was sitting over these drumlins and in a surging state making the drumlins. And that'll tell us about glacier velocity and glacier geometry and where the cracks were on the glacier surface, which we think might play into how drumlins form.
So you'll be able to take those images with you and do measurements and try to understand how the images fit into the real environment?
Yeah. And of course, we can look at those back using GIS techniques and whatnot in the lab back at our universities. But while in the field, our main activity is going to be sampling the sediments of these drumlins. By looking at the sediments, particularly the magnetic properties of the sediments, we can make statements about how the sediment moved beneath the ice cap and arranged itself into these hills. And so that's an important activity that we'll be doing there.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back and continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Neil Iverson. He is a professor and Smith Family Foundation Departmental Chair of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University. In just a couple of weeks, he and a team of researchers will be headed to Iceland, where they will camp near a glacier and research these land formations called drumlins. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the power of glaciers. In a little while, we'll take a look back into the past and talk about how the land that we live on in Iowa was formed by glaciers. Right now, my guest is Neil Iverson. He's professor and Smith Family Foundation Departmental Chair of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University. And in just a couple of weeks, he'll be heading to Iceland, where he and a research team will be studying a landform called drumlins, and they'll be camping in a very remote area near a glacier in Iceland that has created these land formations in the not-too-distant past. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well if you have questions for Professor Iverson. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Neil, this glacier that you'll be studying, can you give me an idea of its health, its integrity, given that we hear a lot about glaciers receding at a rapid pace right now because of global climate change?
Yeah, this glacier is like most glaciers on Earth right now. It is shrinking and shrinking at pretty unprecedented rates. In fact, it's shrinking so fast that it may not surge again. We would actually expect it to surge this decade based on its cycle of surging in the past. But in order for a glacier to surge, there needs to be a healthy enough input of snow to the glacier to get its mass sufficient to allow the glacier to surge. And a lot of, or at least some, formerly surge-type glaciers on Earth are probably becoming non-surge-type glaciers right now because they're unable to develop sufficient mass in between surges to undergo another surge.
Do you feel that you're working against the clock to try to figure out this mystery before things change?
Well, I think there are a lot of researchers out there who I really think are in that boat to some extent. But we're mainly interested in the landscape out in front of the glaciers in this case. And, that sediment record that we're studying is going to be there a long time. And so we're not quite in the same situation as people, for example, who are trying to understand the tidewater glaciers of Alaska that are many of which are shrinking at pretty high rates.
We've talked a lot about the landform, the drumlins, but are you also trying to figure out how this landform affects the glacier? I mean, we were talking about how the glacier creates the landform, but Is there a reciprocal relationship?
That's a really good question, and the answer is yes, and that's one of the effectively one of the reasons our project was funded. Drumlins are hills, of course, and they exist out in front of some modern glaciers, not very many. We have vast fields of drumlins from the last ice age, and recently we've learned that there are drumlins beneath pretty large portions of the Antarctic ice sheet. And it turns out those hills at the bottom of the glacier affect the way parts of the Antarctic ice sheet move. And that's because one of the ways glaciers move is by sliding over their beds. And if there are hills there, and those hills are sort of rigid lumps at the bottom of the glacier, ice has to flow around those lumps, and that slows the ice down. There's a drag associated with that. It's analogous, for example, to air moving across the landscape as wind. If there are trees on the landscape, those trees slow down the wind. We all know that if we stand in a forest, we don't get blasted by the wind the same way we'd get blasted out on the prairie. Well, when there are rigid lumps beneath the glacier, that slows down the fluid ice, and that affects the rate at which glaciers ultimately in Antarctica convey their ice to the adjacent ocean. And that conveyance of ice to the ocean affects sea level rise. And it's one of the main uncertainties in trying to predict sea level rise over the next century. What flux of ice is going to be delivered to the world oceans due to the speed up of glaciers? And so by understanding how drumlins form, we hopefully can build better models of how glaciers move.
You've called the formation of drumlins to be something of a mystery, something that people have been trying to figure out for 150 years. Do you have a working hypothesis?
Well, let me give you the leading hypothesis, and that is that when glaciers are sitting on top of a sediment substrate, that the drainage of that substrate, the water drainage through that substrate, is thought to be quite heterogeneous because the hydraulic properties of glacial substrates tend to vary a lot from place to place. And so in places where the bed of the glacier is pretty well drained, the sediment should be stronger for reasons I won't go into. And if the sediment is stronger, those places where the sediment is stronger can form the lumps or nuclei that ultimately allow drumlins to develop. That's sort of the leading hypothesis. Because the sediment beneath the glacier tends to move, and if it's moving along and encounters a rigid lump, it'll pile up on that lump and form a hill. Our hypothesis is quite different, and it's based on observations of these drumlins in Iceland. Our hypothesis is that drumlins form where there are clusters of cracks on the glacier surface, And because of the stress distribution that produces at the bottom of the glacier, sediments will tend to move at the bottom of the glacier towards places where there are cracks on the glacier surface. And that could be responsible for drumlin formation as well. And the measurements that we are going to make there in August should allow us to distinguish between those two quite different hypotheses.
Why do you think it's important for us to understand how glaciers move?
Well, there are several reasons for that. Probably the most important is the one I already alluded to, the fact that glacier movement affects the rate at which ice is delivered to the world oceans, and that in turn affects sea level rise. Another reason for trying to understand how glaciers move is that our very best climate archives for the last million years are stored in glacier ice. And as snow accumulates on ice sheets, there are lots of geochemical signals that are stored in that snow, and that ultimately gets pressed into ice and stored in the ice sheet. Some of that ice at the bottom of thick ice sheets is almost a million years old. And so that gives us, when we take a core of ice downward through the ice sheet, that gives us a really good record of climate variability over that period. However, that record is only as good as the chronology of that record, or basically our ability to say how old the ice is at a given depth. And to do that, we need to know how to model glacier flow, it turns out, because the flow affects the distribution of ice age as a function of depth. And so another reason for being interested in the flow of modern glaciers is that if we can get that right, our records of past climate will be improved.
I've heard that you do an interesting experiment to demonstrate to students at Iowa State University how glaciers move. Can you describe what you do in the classroom for me?
Well, one of the things I sometimes do is I bring in a block of ice out of a freezer. There's a big freezer in my lab that we do experiments in. I take the block of ice and I simply put it on a big board, and I tip the board. And of course, we all know. And of course, the block of ice, when it gets out of the freezer, it starts to melt, and all the students can see a layer of water forming underneath that block of ice. And the same layer of water exists beneath glaciers, or at least lots of glaciers. Not all glaciers, but most glaciers are actively melting at their beds. And that's what allows ice to slip across their beds, this layer of water that's usually less than, certainly less than a millimeter thick. And so in class, I simply allow the ice block to start melting, and then I tip the board, and of course the ice block goes accelerating off the board onto the floor and usually breaks up into a bunch of pieces. So at that point, I ask the question, why don't glaciers undergo this acceleration? Why don't glaciers slide just like this block of ice? Because they're often sitting on an inclined slope and have an inclined surface slope. Why don't they do this? And the reason for that is that there are bumps underneath real glaciers that the ice has to flow around. And of course, drumlins are a particularly big bump that develops beneath glaciers. And as I've said, we're interested in them because they do affect the flow velocity of glaciers.
I'm talking with Professor Neil Iverson. He's a geologist. He's also the Departmental Chair of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University. We're talking about his research into glaciers, and you're welcome to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Neil, when did you first get interested in glaciers?
I got interested in glaciers as a junior high and high school student who was very fortunate to visit some high alpine areas with my family. And we visited some glaciers, and that's where I was first introduced to them, in places like Glacier Park and in the Wind River Mountains in Wyoming. And that got me interested in glaciers to some extent. And then when I got to Iowa State as an undergraduate student here, I was also really interested in structural geology, which is the aspect of geology that deals with the deformation of rocks. And isochorus is a mineral and a rock. It just happens to be a mineral and a rock that has a melting temperature that we all experience here on Earth's surface. And so I was interested in trying to combine both glaciology and structural geology. And so I went off to the University of Minnesota, where there were faculty who did both of those things, and started off as a graduate student and ended up living for about 3 months out in front of a glacier in Sweden, and then kept studying them, and have been ever since.
So you described the conditions out in front of a glacier in Iceland. I'm guessing that they're similar in a lot of places. What was it about that experience, about being near a glacier, that made you want to dedicate your life to this work?
Glaciers are just really, really spectacular features on the Earth's surface, and they give rise to, in my view, Earth's most spectacular landscapes. Mountains like the Himalayas and the Alps and most of the Rockies wouldn't look anything like they do today if it weren't for the effects of glaciers taking river valleys and eroding them out into valleys like Yosemite Valley, with these fantastic steep walls and short, sharp horn peaks and so on. So that was really my attraction to them, I think. And I think that's the attraction for a lot of people who work on glaciers. And I think as those of us who work on glaciers see them recede at such a rapid rate, it's almost somewhat emotional to watch them disappear like that. It's a component of Earth's hydrosphere that's really compromised right now, and that's sad in a way.
Do you think that this is something, the fact that glaciers do tend to be so remote, although most of us live on land, many of us at least, live on land that was formed by glaciers. Do you think that this is something that the general public tends to just ignore or take for granted?
Oh, I suspect so. And I don't think that's very surprising. And I think, one of our goals in doing research that's sponsored by the National Science Foundation is to try to improve that awareness. And that's why we have on our team this Polar Trek high school teacher who will be working really hard on outreach-related tasks, both during the field work and during the year following the field work.
When kids get introduced to the idea of global warming and that glaciers are melting at an accelerated speed, that's kind of an overwhelming idea to understand, to even comprehend. And of course, a lot of kids, when they learn about environmental issues, also are faced with a tremendous feeling of helplessness as well. What do you think is the most powerful thing for young people, whether they're college students or kids or really any of us? What is the most powerful thing for us to understand about glaciers?
Well, I think a really important thing is that the landscape we live in and the soils we depend on for agriculture, of course, are wouldn't be anything like they are today in places like Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota and across the northern part of the U.S. if it were not for the effects of glaciation. If you, travel to southern Missouri or extreme southern Indiana and look at the soil there, it's a very thin, relatively infertile soil sitting right on top of bedrock. And that's precisely what we'd have here in Iowa if it weren't for the effects of glaciation. And so I think for kids in Iowa, that's a really important point to make.
As you're preparing to go, obviously you're focused a lot on your research, but is there something personally that you're excited about being out there next to the glacier this summer?
One of the things I'm really excited about is that our research team, I think, consists of a lot of really good people who will be fun to work with in very close quarters. When you're camping with people, it's important that they be pretty upbeat and maintain a good sense of humor.
Especially when you're camping in the cold and the wet and the rain and
exactly,
the wind.
Exactly. It's real easy to get a little bit negative when you've been wet all day and are shivering and need to get back to camp and so on. And so it's just important to have the right group. And I'm really confident that this group is going to be really good that way.
Given that you're right next to a glacier, what is your source of water while you're there?
There are a lot. There's lots of water coming off the glacier, but it tends to be rapidly moving in what we would call outwash streams. And that water, in order to drink it, you have to take a bunch of it in a bucket or something and let all the silt settle out of it. Glaciers produce lots of silt and sand, and rapidly moving glacial waters contain that silt and sand right up in the flow, and you don't want to drink that. It does bad things to your digestive tract. And so what we usually do is drink water out of a couple of little ponds near our camp, which is a lot clearer water. Unfortunately, as I said, there's lots of waterfowl in the area, and they have left their droppings all around these ponds. And so we're always kind of scratching our heads as to whether we should drink the water without treating it. And we did that last year, and for the most part did pretty well. One person got a little bit ill for reasons that are still unknown. But in any case, that's what we intend to do.
All right. Well, Neil Iverson, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
And I hope you find what you're looking for this summer.
Thanks a lot.
Neil Iverson is professor and Smith Family Foundation Departmental Chair of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University. His research team has received a three-year, $400,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to study a landform called drumlins. They'll be heading to Iceland very soon, while they'll be camping for several weeks near a glacier there. And in just a moment, we will look back into the past and talk about how glaciers shaped the state of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've been talking about what we can still learn from glaciers in our world today, but now we're going to look into the past at the glaciers that formed the land we live on. Deborah Quaid is Supervisor of Geology and Groundwater Section at the Iowa Geological and Water Survey, and she is with me now. So, Deb, let's go back 2.5 million years to the beginning of the Pleistocene epoch. Can you tell me a little bit about what the Earth was like at this time?
Charity, it's great to be here today. Yes, 2.5 million years ago, Iowa was the start of numerous glaciations, probably, you know, between 2.5 million years up to about 12,000 years ago. Iowa's been subjected to probably as many as 10 glacial advances. So,
all right, and when you say glaciation or glacial advance, mm-hmm. what does that mean?
That means we're basically talking about those glaciers that Neil is going to be studying. They were advancing from the Arctic or subarctic regions and making their way, flowing or sliding, as Neil was mentioning, into the mid-continent, so covering the Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, good parts of Illinois, and actually almost into central Missouri.
All right. And so when you say that happened maybe 10 times, so those glaciers would come over this area and then recede?
Yeah, they would retreat in a sense with the Pleistocene, with those early glaciations. Those were thousands of feet thick ice, maybe up to several miles. And so with those, I think there was some retreat going on. With the more recent advance of ice into Iowa, we know that it basically stagnated. And so we see totally different features. So, yeah, Iowa really, when you look at, you know, the southern part of Iowa especially, that's where we really probably see the product of those early glaciations. And we, in the past, you might have heard people use these terms, Kansan and Nebraska, and they thought there were just two glacial advances. But we now know during that period of time between 2.5 million to probably 500,000 years ago, there were probably at least seven of those advances of that glacial ice into the state and then retreats. And there were intervening warm periods of time that we call interglacials. And during those, we could have had vegetation on the landscape, soil forming processes going on. And we do see that when we go into quarries or we're able to take a core of soil, we'll see these older soils that we call buried soils or a fossil soil. And so all that's there, but it's not always real apparent on the land surface.
Okay, and when you say in southern Iowa we can see those earlier glaciations, so give me an idea. In southern Iowa, then the most recent glacier didn't actually move that far south.
No, and maybe we should just start with the most recent glacier.
Okay.
And that's a sort of a thumb-shaped protrudence, you know, right in the central part of the state that we call that the Des Moines Lobe, and that's because that lobe of ice sort of looks like an earlobe. And basically that there was a large sheet of ice that we call the Laurentide Ice Sheet, and there were little lobes of ice or fingers of ice that flowed further south. And one of those sort of crossed through the Dakotas in through southwestern Minnesota and into north central Iowa and actually advanced as far south as Des Moines. In fact, the state capitol complex sits right on that we would call the terminal moraine or ridge of that Des Moines lobe.
All right. And how do we know that? Because obviously we didn't see those glaciers.
Well, we know it because of the materials or the soils. Actually, Iowa being a highly productive state, we have soil maps for every county. And the geologists and the soil scientists all, you know, are able to identify that we have these sort of fine-grained glacial materials that, you know, are present with no wind-blown lust cover on it in that central portion of the state. And so we know that's the most recently glaciated portion because we don't have the wind-blown lust and we have the actual younger tills. Also, it's sort of like a baby's bottom or a youthful face. We have no real the surface in terms of our integrated drainage. We don't have an integrated drainage network. That's all those potholes. That's why we have to tile many of the areas on the Des Moines
Lobe. And so when you say potholes, we're talking about little wetland areas.
Yeah, that's those little dark areas when you're driving on I-35 north of Des Moines, headed up to Ames and maybe on up to Minneapolis. You'll see all these little low-lying areas and fields, and you'll see the darker soils. And those are just very organic-rich soils that at one point, probably before they were drained, had little marshes or sloughs in those little. And so, and we all have evidence that, especially the floods of 1993 and maybe even 2008, all those little potholes were full of water for a week or two at that time.
Right, right, absolutely. So, and when we talk about the Des Moines Lobe, that thumb shape reaching right down, for people who are in Des Moines and familiar with Des Moines, there's a hill that, of course, a lot of people are very familiar with, where the state capitol is. Tell me about that hill and how the glaciers would have formed that.
Well, you know, when that thumb-shaped, you know, or lobe-shaped ice moved into Iowa, it advanced to the Des Moines area, but it was sort of a concentric band. And so you can follow that shape all throughout Iowa, and you can start up, sort of in Ocheyedan area and move south to Storm Lake area and on down to Springbrook State Park, Des Moines, and then make your way back east over towards State Center, on up to Eldora, Clear Lake, and you can see that outline, and that's the end moraine for the Des Moines Lobe, and that basically was caused by the ice was debris-rich, and it sort of plowed up and gouged up material, and so there was a ridge right there at the snout of that glacial ice, and so as the ice melted, it's left that positive relief feature on our landscape, which is the end moraine.
All right, and that last glaciation in the state, tell me about the difference between the soil that was left behind by that last glaciation and the soil that you'd find elsewhere in the state. Because, of course, I mean, Iowa is famous for its rich, rich soil, but that soil is the richest, right?
Yes, yes. It tends to be a loamy soil, and it oftentimes has very high organic matter content. It had a very rich prairie going on it, as well as many areas. You had these poorly drained areas where you had lots of organics accumulating. So it's an organic-rich, loamy material, and it can be highly productive. But as I mentioned, drainage is an issue. Probably the most productive soil in Iowa is actually just off the Des Moines Lobe, and that's where you have older glacial tills that are mantled with the wind blowing less. And just as an aside, Neil was talking about how there's lots of water issuing out at the snout of the glacier, you know, and that there's a lot of wind at that glacier. So you have to remember, especially the Missouri River Valley was actually carrying lots of meltwater probably between the last 30 to 12,000 years ago. And as it would dry up in the glacial winter, those winds would pick that silt that Neil mentioned, that really flower-sized material, out of those valleys and carry it eastward. And so that's how we end up with the Les Hills, as we know it, adjacent to the Missouri River Valley.
So they were shaped not by the glacier, but by the environment created by the glacier.
They're like a huge sand dune. They're primarily silt, but they're also, if you look closely at those deposits, there can be very fine sand in those. And that right there at the edge, if you drive up I-29 and you look to the east, it looks like a coastline almost. And they look like you can envision huge dunes or snow drifts. But because of some erosional processes, you'll see the little sharp crested ridges on top. Now, if you approach from the east, it has an entirely different appearance because those features are sort of muted, and so you sort of run up on the Les Hills, but they sort of sneak up on you in a sense. But you really get a sense of those dune-like forms when you look at the Les Hills from the west, looking eastward.
Okay, interesting.
But that Les, yeah, is that actually mantles a good portion of Iowa, and the Les is very productive. So the state soil of Iowa is the Tama silt loam. And, you know, we all know where Tama, Iowa is. And, so that in eastern Iowa, those Tama soils are highly productive soils.
Interesting. All right, Keith is on the line from Iowa Falls. And, Keith, Deb may have just answered your question because you wanted to talk about the Les area, right?
Well, yeah, I guess I have a question. We don't have drumlins in Iowa, correct?
No, we do not.
But we do have paja.
Oh, yes, we have pajas.
Okay, and what are pajas?
A paja is really, they're sort of isolated, elongated, ridge-type features, and they don't occur on the Des Moines Lobe. The pajas really occur in east-central Iowa on a landform region we call the Iowan erosion surface, and that's exactly how they formed. They really represent the relict, older pre-Illinoian till surface. And then between 21,000 and 16,500 years ago, we had an intense cold period in Iowa, sort of tundra-type conditions. And so we had frozen ground in that area, or permafrost, if you're familiar with those terms. And then we had rain start falling, and it would warm up in the summers, and you actually had that frozen ground slumping and moving. And so we were able to strip high volumes of sediment off that landscape. And these pajas appear to be the erosional relics of that older pre-Illinoian surface. So when we collect a core through those, we'll find the younger wind-blowing Les. And then below it, we find two of those fossil buried soils. One is probably developed between 22 and 28,000 years ago. The other one, one's called the Farmdale soil. The other one's called the Sangamon. And the Sangamon soil is probably much older and may have developed 180 to 100,000 years ago. And then that Sangamon soil is developed in one of those older pre-Illinoian tills. So the whole package is there. So they're really erosional remnants.
Okay.
So they're not drumlins.
All right. Well, Keith, and did you have – I had to distract us there because I wanted everyone to know what pajas were, and I wanted to know what they were. So what is your question?
Well, I had a question, and she perhaps answered it already, but back in the dark ages when I studied soil science, there was a thought that Paha originated from originally drumlins formed in that glacial till, but is that no longer a hypothesis?
You know, I don't think so. It's too bad Neil's not here to answer that question because he is probably more of a drumlin expert. But I would question whether or not we ever had drumlins in Iowa. It may have more to do with the material, the basal material that those glaciers would have been running over was primarily in Iowa, sedimentary rock, so softer rock. So it may have not been the resistant material that Neil was talking about, those lumps that the glacier flows around. That's not really my area of expertise, but you're talking at a minimum 500,000 years of erosion, so we'll never really be able to answer those questions. But I don't know that it's real likely that we ever had drumlins in Iowa, just because the fact that we're primarily sedimentary rock.
Deb, as we drive through the state of Iowa, as we grow things in this rich soil, why is it important for people to understand where all of this came from?
Well, I think it's really important. I think that appreciating our landscape is integral to knowing who we are. And what I always say about Iowa, it's not like you go to Colorado and it's dazzling and spectacular and beautiful. But, you know, Iowa, as I always say, Iowa is the girl you take home to mom. She grows on you. The more you look at the landscape, the more you see the subtle beauty and intricacies of it. You know, I was fortunate to grow up on the lobe in Des Moines, or in Iowa on the Des Moines lobe. And I think it really, you know, living on such a flat landscape, it really made me realize that there was actually quite a bit of relief and a number of landforms out there. And so I think that's my takeaway message, is that I think we can all be better stewards of the land if we have a better understanding of where our landforms came from and where we came from.
Well, Deb, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Deborah Quaid is supervisor of the geology and groundwater section at the Iowa Geological and Water Survey. This hour, we've been talking about glaciers, which, of course, shape the land that we all live on in Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Jason Burns. You can podcast our show or get on-demand audio on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And of course, you can email us anytime. We'd love to hear your feedback on things you've heard on the show. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me now is Ben Kiefer. He's the host of River to River, coming up today at noon. It's Politics Day. What are you going to talk about,
Ben? Oh, yes, you did. Sorry, it's one of our favorite days of the week on River to River, Politics Day. And, of course, we've been hearing in the news how the Senate stepped back from the edge of a partisan clash late yesterday over President Obama's executive branch nominees. So we're going to ask our analysts, what does not going nuclear, as the terminology has been, how does that affect work in the Senate? Is it a long-term thing, short-term fix? Is it a new era for the Senate? Also, the Snowden affair continuing with NSA, and we'll talk about things like why Microsoft is lobbying the government, complaining actually, because it cannot, it is prohibited from sharing the NSA's customer data requests. So why does Microsoft want you, as possibly a Microsoft customer, to know more about what the NSA wants to know about you from Microsoft?
I don't know that I followed that, Ben, but I'm fascinated.
Okay. Also, of course, the Iowa couple honored at the White House for its their nonprofit outreach at the White House with President Obama and George H.W. Bush, too.
Right. And who are your guests today?
Guests this week, Wayne Moyer and Tim Hagel. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Always insightful comments from both of them. We hope you'll join our conversation, Politics Wednesday, coming up at noon. Charity, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot, Ben. Our theme music for Talk of Iowa was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with people who are transgendered about their personal experiences. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.